Hello and welcome back to the KPMG Financial Reporting Podcast. I am your host, Nick Tricarci, and today's topic is the SEC. With President Trump taking office in January, we've already seen significant shifts in both the SEC's leadership and its priorities. So today, I'm joined by our SEC topic team leader, Tim Brown. Now, you might remember the last time Tim was on. It was right before the election, and we made a whole bunch of predictions of what might happen at the SEC if Trump won. Well, it turns out that each of those predictions has already come true, even though we're only 2 months into this new administration. So things are certainly happening very quickly. Today, we're going to both give you an update of what's been going on at the SEC, and then we're going to double down by predicting what might still be to come in the year ahead. Tim Brown, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Nick. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so Tim, the last time we spoke was right before the presidential election, actually, and it was one of my favorite episodes. I got in a Back to the Future reference. You busted out your magic eight ball to predict what might happen to the SEC's agenda based on who became president. Overall, just it was a lot of fun, and I'm going to go through our scorecard to see how we did in a minute. But Tim, I first wanted to just ask you to give us an update on what's happened at the SEC since we last spoke.
Since last time we spoke, there's been a lot happening at the SEC for sure. So obviously we had the inauguration of President Trump in January. And around that time, Gary Gensler, who was now the former chair of the SEC, and Jaime Lizarraga, who is one of the former Democratic commissioners, they both stepped down from their roles at the commission. Again, both of those effective in January. And so we're down to three commissioners at this point. We know now that President Trump has nominated Paul Atkins to serve as the new chairman. He was a commissioner previously at the SEC, so someone that we've seen before and certainly is out there a lot with his, you know, kind of public statements and remarks. So we know a little bit about where we think he might go. He was a commissioner under George W. Bush. You know, the Senate confirmation hearing has not yet been scheduled, but we're thinking it's coming soon, maybe in the next month or two.
Tim, on this point, it kind of feels like it's been taking a long time because Trump nominated Atkins all the way back in December. But this is actually pretty normal, right? At least in terms of what we've seen in recent history.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think the last couple of chairpersons were appointed April or May timeframe, I want to say. And since then, Commissioner Mark Ueda, one of the existing Republican commissioners, has actually been named as the acting chair of the SEC for the time being.
Yeah, so there's certainly been a lot of action as it relates to the makeup of the commissioners, but we've also seen a lot of activity come from this new commission already under acting chair Ueda, so much so that we can already grade ourselves on our pre-election predictions, even though we're only 2 months into Trump's second term. So without further ado, Tim, let's get into it. So your big picture prediction when we spoke in November was that we would enter into a period of deregulation and we'd see more of a focus on capital formation under a Republican-led commission. Both of those turned out to be true as the White House has issued an executive order called Unleashing Prosperity Through Deregulation. And we've already seen a bunch of remarks from Ueda about the ways the SEC is looking to make it easier for companies to access the public markets, which we'll get into a little bit more here in a minute. So you're one for one, or two for two, I guess, depending on how you want to look at it. And then if we dive into some of your more specific predictions, I had asked you, what the outlook was like for the SEC's climate rule if Trump won the election, and you predicted with the help of your magic eight ball that outlook was not so good. And again, that turned out to be spot on because already, Acting Chair Ueda has directed his staff to pause its defense of the climate rule in court, which probably signals the SEC may be looking to either rescind it or significantly water it down. So, right again. And then lastly, you predicted that the outlook was good for the crypto industry, meaning that this Republican commission would take a friendlier posture. We also speculated that SAB 121 would be repealed. Both of those turned out to be correct. We saw SAB 121 repealed just days after Ueda became acting chair, and we've seen a flurry of activity on the crypto front from the establishment of a new task force to a number of enforcement cases against crypto companies being dropped. So, Tim, I think what I'm saying is that you batted 1,000. Nice work.
Nostradamus, move over. The Magic 8-Ball is in town.
Yeah, exactly. So, Tim, I hope you brought it back with you, because I'm going to ask you to double down here in a second on the prediction front. But first, I wanted to quickly go back to something else that we had talked about last time. You had explained how the commission was structured and that 3 commissioners come from the political party of the White House and 2 come from the other party, and that it takes 3 votes to pass a rule. However, now that we only have 3 commissioners, as you mentioned, so we got Mark Ueda and Hester Peirce from the Republican side and Caroline Crenshaw from the Democrats, how does that dynamic impact the SEC's ability to carry out rulemaking?
Yeah, that's a great question, Nick. And I think it's one that we get a lot, right? Like what's happening now, this kind of grace period we have before we have a full commission. But as of now, under the rules of the Sunshine Act, the commission has a quorum. They need to have 3 commissioners, and we have that. So Acting Chair Ueda can conduct commission business. So you might be wondering, well, there's 3 commissioners, they're able to conduct business under the Sunshine Act. When's the rulemaking, you know, bonanza going to start here? And the problem that the Republicans actually have at the moment is you need to have 3 commissioners to conduct a vote. Well, you might say, Tim, we have 3 commissioners. But if you think about it, all Commissioner Crenshaw has to do is not show up to the meeting, and they don't have 3 votes. So in effect, Commissioner Crenshaw really has the power to abstain, and Republicans could not push through rulemaking because of that.
So I think what we're saying is that we're not really expecting to see any official rulemaking until incoming Chair Paul Atkins gets confirmed and takes office. But as our scorecard showed, that doesn't mean that the commission won't be very active until that point in time. And in fact, Acting Chair Ueda has been quite vocal about what he thinks the SEC is going to be doing over the coming year. So I wanted to ask you to just give us some insights on where things might be headed.
And remember, Ueda and Peirce and Atkins all worked together before. So during Atkins' first term as commissioner, Ueda and Peirce were both attorneys for Atkins. So they know each other really well. They've worked together before. They share a similar vision. So I think we're going to see this move pretty quickly. I think what we're going to see the Republicans say is that, and what we're hearing from Ueda early on, is they term this as less regulation by enforcement. And Ueda mentions that they're going to uphold the existing securities laws as written. Again, the Republicans are thinking about this as what's on the books, what do the securities laws and regulations say, and we're going to go after those bad actors, those real, you know, fraudsters that are violating the securities laws directly and purposefully and egregiously. We're going to see lots of enforcement cases taken against them. In particular, when the SEC perceives that there's fraud that's impacting the retail customer. So besides that, I think we've also heard Ueda say that there's just going to be less regulation overall. So, you know, forgetting the enforcement division, the SEC is not going to create as much regulation. So we've already heard President Trump say that for each new regulation, and this isn't particular to the SEC, but for the entire government, for each new regulation, 10 other regulations need to be repealed. So does that impact the SEC? Is the SEC subject to this executive order that President Trump has put out? I think we'll wait to see if that's the case. It's hard to imagine that 10 securities laws are going to be repealed every time a new regulation is put out. But at the same time, maybe that means that no new regulations are put out. Maybe that merely means that existing regulations are modified. And so maybe the remarks that Ueda has made to say that we're going to move very slowly on new regulation, maybe that means there's no new regulation per se, but really just changes to existing regulations.
And Tim, I think the other thing that we've seen through some of these executive orders is that agency has need to actually confirm with the White House before they issue a new rule. Would that apply here for the SEC as well?
Yeah, that's a great point, Nick. And I believe that the expectation that we have at this point is yes. So we expect that the SEC is probably going to need to take things to the White House. I mean, what does that mean? I think that if nothing else, that slows everything down, right? The regulatory process is long and burdensome. Adding more burdens along the way can only add time. And is there an impact of that process on what ultimately comes out? Perhaps.
Yeah, Tim, to your point about it taking a long time, Acting Chair Ueda himself referred to it as steering a cruise ship. So I think that gives you a pretty good idea of what he's talking about. But you know, I think that's with respect to new regulations. You also mentioned that the SEC may look to modify existing regulations. And the ones that we've seen Ueda mention in his speeches so far all seem to be focused on capital formation. So that's what I want to talk about. But to tee up my question on capital formation, I want to throw some stats at you, courtesy of the Wall Street Journal. Last year, companies raised $32 billion from traditional IPOs. And although that sounds like a lot, because, well, it is, it's well below the 10-year average of close to $50 billion. And last year, there were fewer than 4,000 public companies in the U.S., which is down significantly from the 7,000-ish public companies that we had back in the late 90s. So with all that foreshadowing, Tim, what can we expect to see from this SEC in an attempt to potentially reverse some of those trends?
So I do think we're going to see those numbers turn around. I think that's the general expectation that I've heard out there in the marketplace as well. And everything that the SEC has done so far in these couple of months and everything we're expecting them to do has an eye towards, you know, making sure that more companies can become public. Those numbers will tick up from where they've been. And I think the commission really sees that as important to our capital markets and the free flowing capital that we have, you know, within those capital markets. So let's get into it a little bit. We've already heard through Acting Chair Ueda, the SEC may review the EGC definition and recommend changes to that, including how companies may qualify, the duration for which a company may be an EGC, and then also kind of how do you come out of being an EGC and just becoming a normal everyday kind of public company, making that kind of transition and off-ramp from the EGC status easier rather than just having the cliff that kind of exists today when you lose EGC status.
By EGC, you mean emerging growth company. And the benefit there is if you're an EGC, as long as you qualify for that status, you have some reduced regulatory compliance requirements, right? As compared to, quote, a normal public company.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Nick. And, you know, by extending some of these permissions or the allowances that are given to EGCs, you know, that's an easy way for companies to decrease compliance costs, and especially early on in their life cycle of being a public company.
Yeah, and I think that notion of extending some of the allowances, to use your words, in the existing regulations has come up quite a bit in Acting Chair Ueda's initial remarks. I mean, in addition to looking at the EGC thresholds, he also mentioned targeting improvements for exempt offerings, which I think could come in the form of revising some of those financial thresholds. And then just recently, we saw the commission take action that's along these same themes of one, you know, encouraging more companies to access the public markets, and two, increasing the allowances under existing regulations. And that was done in the way of making changes to the SEC's confidential review process. So Tim, I want to ask you just explain the confidential review process quickly, and then talk about what changes we just saw the SEC make on that front.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, so we've had this confidential submission process or confidential review process in place for years now. And it's really only been available to certain entities. And those include entities that are conducting an initial public offering or IPO, as well as entities in their first year of their life cycle. And what the commission has now said is that they're opening this up to any company. So you don't have to only be in the first year of being public any longer to take advantage of confidential reviews. And so the first registration statement that you're submitting to the staff can be on this confidential basis, which really opens up an ability for companies to start the process a little bit earlier, maybe not have all the information available, get reviews in, get comments back before perhaps they would have been ready earlier or, you know, historically. And so what does that do? That just kind of accelerates the capital formation process, if you will, for these entities, enabling them to get to markets quicker and earlier or sooner than they would have otherwise been able to. So I do expect that this is going to be popular and companies are going to start taking advantage of this pretty quickly here now that the SEC has said that this is available. Not only that, but I think they've also expanded this permission or ability to confidentially submit registration statements more broadly to foreign issuers as well. So, you know, it's open to everybody at this point per what the statement has said. And again, the Republicans are hoping to just open up the capital markets in whatever way they can. Some of this, I think they see as low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, I think the other change they made was they also opened it up for de-SPAC transactions, you know, in certain situations. And so I'm not going to speculate on whether we're going to see a comeback in the SPAC market, but the change they made for this confidential review, they did expand it to those types of transactions as well. So yeah, I mean, it seems like a good benefit, right? You can submit to the SEC confidentially, have them review, go through the comment letter process before you've made that information public. And so it's a good way for a company to, you know, sort that out before they make their first public S1 filing. Or as you alluded to, you know, now that once you are public, you might do other registration statements and this confidential review process will now be available regardless of how long you've been a public company. So Tim, you mentioned costs to reduce, you know, going public. I think what I just mentioned was somewhat of a combination after you've been public. And I want to segue that to see, you know, do we have any expectations that the SEC is going to look to lower compliance costs for existing public companies?
We do, Nick. So, it's another great point. From what Acting Chair Ueda has said in some of his speeches, he indicated that they want to relook at the filing status thresholds as well. And so what does that mean? Well, right now for accelerated filers, for large accelerated filers, there are these requirements such as Sarbanes-Oxley controls audits that have to be done on an annual basis. To the extent that something like a smaller reporting company definition is expanded, as was done a number of years ago, to the extent that the accelerated filer definitions are increased again, that may mean reducing some of the burdens and compliance costs for a company to be public.
Another, I don't know if it's a complaint, but just an interesting thing is there's a lot of overlap between some of these categories of filing status, right? Between large accelerated filer, small reporting company, EGC. And it can be really complicated to figure out like what your status is, whether you have status as more than one type, and what does that mean from a disclosure perspective. But it sounds like Ueda wants to simplify that and eliminate some of that overlap so it's not as confusing to figure out, you know, which category you're in. But then I think he's also talked about how, you know, right now the only real difference between a large accelerated filer and an accelerated filer is the number of days for filing deadlines for, you know, 10Qs and 10Ks, for example. And it sounded like he might be interested in exploring opportunities to look for further opportunities to scale disclosures between each category. So as you move up the chain from, you know, the smallest type of public company to the biggest type of public company, your disclosure obligations would likewise increase. Is that a fair assessment of what they might be looking at?
Absolutely. And I think to your point, really anything might be on the table at this point.
Yeah. So just to do a quick recap and maybe tie it back into our conversation earlier on rulemaking, although we think the rulemaking might be slow, I think what we're both saying here is that any new rulemaking that we do see come out of this commission is certainly not going to increase any of the periodic disclosure requirements, right? In fact, I think we're saying it's probably going to go the opposite direction by rolling back some existing requirements in order to further reduce the cost of going public and staying public. So Tim, one other thing that Acting Chair Ueda has mentioned in his remarks is the retail investor. And I was actually just recently watching an old interview with incoming chair Paul Atkins, where he mentioned that retail investors don't get the same pop when investing in IPOs that they used to, you know, back in the day. And that's because companies are staying private longer because of all the access they have to private capital. And so by the time they do go public, it's almost more like an exit event for those private investors. And, you know, one of the ways the SEC might try to address this is by looking at the definition of an accredited investor. I think we've heard that from U8 already. And that's because if someone meets that definition, then they have access to more investment opportunities, particularly as it relates to private companies. So with that being said, what changes might we expect to see to that definition?
So, I mean, if we think about the reason these definitions were put in place, it's really to protect the investor. And the thinking there initially was that if you're not sophisticated enough, then you're potentially open to more scams. You're open to putting more of your own capital at risk and maybe not understanding where those risks are coming from. I think the Republicans see this more as, if we, to your point, really open up the markets to more people, they have an ability to expand on their own capital base and be more successful within our capital market. So, I mean, I think what we see maybe coming from this commission is a way to increase or expand the criteria that are used to qualify. That could come through by changing the accredited investor definition. So who is an accredited investor? Does it make sense that it's such a high hurdle at this point, and maybe creating a lot more accredited investors, if you will, just by reducing the thresholds that you need to actually meet the accredited investor definition in the first place? What that does is it opens up a lot more capital to these companies. It also increases the opportunities for a lot more people to make investments.
So, Tim, let me get you out of here with this question, which is a big one. I guess as you look into your magic eight ball, what else could we expect to see from this Republican-led commission over the next few years, let's call it?
Yeah, I mean, I think just to recap kind of where we're coming from, Nick, this podcast is that the SEC is going to have a lighter touch moving forward for public companies. If you're a public company, I think we're going to see less in the way of regulation, whether that's through fewer or reduced regulations, amending what is required at the moment, increasing thresholds for disclosures, as we've talked about. Some of the things we haven't talked about as much is, I don't think we're going to see as much in the way of comment letters, just volume, right? So we frequently get questions about comment letters and kind of regulation through comments. And I still expect there to be comments, and I think they're going to be informed comments and intelligent comments coming from the staff, and probably on the same trajectory in terms of the topics where we historically see comments, I just think we're going to have a lower volume overall.
Well, Tim, I think you just made a lot of our listeners pretty happy with those remarks. So let's end on that note. And, you know, Tim, appreciate you being here as always and keeping us updated on what's going on at the commission. This is certainly a very active and dynamic time right now. So I know you're going to be all over it, and we're going to be all over it, publishing our thoughts on these new developments, whether it's on this podcast or on our FRV website or otherwise. So, you know, please stay tuned. And I think I'm going to have you back on later this year, and we can see how your batting average is doing.
All right. Looking forward to it, Nick. Thanks. Take care.
So we're starting a new segment for our podcast, which I'm calling The Bottom Line. Basically, what I'm going to do is spend a few minutes at the end of each episode talking about what my key takeaways were from the conversation, so you can get the updates you need, even if you only have just a few minutes to spare. So from today's conversation, I think there were three main things that I took away. One, there have been significant leadership changes already at the SEC. President Trump has nominated Paul Atkins to serve as the chairman, and we expect his confirmation to come in the next month or so. In the meantime, Mark Ueda, one of the existing Republican commissioners, has been appointed acting chair and has already been very active. Number two, we are entering a period of deregulation. Consistent with the executive orders that we've seen come out of the White House, we expect rulemaking at the SEC to be slow. And rather than create new regulations, we think it's more likely that this commission will look to modify existing regulations by rolling back some of the disclosure requirements or making certain exemptions more widely available. We also expect to see less regulation by enforcement, meaning the SEC will look to enforce its existing rules, but maybe not attempt to create new ones through its enforcement actions. And number three, and finally, there will be a heavy focus on facilitating capital formation under this commission. We've already seen the SEC expand its confidential review process for all filers and virtually all registration statements. Acting Chair Ueda has also talked about increasing the thresholds for emerging growth companies in order to attract companies to go public earlier on in their life cycle. He's also talked about looking for opportunities to simplify the exempt offering regime and scaling disclosure requirements based on a company's filing status. But like everything else these days, things are happening extremely quickly. So please make sure to subscribe and give us 5 stars so you can stay up to date on what's going on. We really do appreciate your support, and it helps us reach more listeners like you. We also have a really great weekly newsletter that you can subscribe to by going to our FRV website. It brings you all of KPMG's thought leadership in one place, and that way you never miss out, whether it's on this podcast or online. And thank you again for listening. We will talk to you later.